been engaged in secret discussions about the Hyeot Hospital all spring. It is claimed that jobs in one hospital department could be saved if another, more cost-heavy department was closed immediately. Somehow the paper has managed to find out from a reliable source that the department that the leading elite of establishment politicians would prefer to save has more employees who live in Hyeot, while the one threatened with closure has more staff living in Beartown. This later turns out not to be the case, but by then it won't matter, because all summer the headline is More Unemployment for Beartown. The comments section does what the comments section always does, smells blood and catches fire. At one point during the summer, a female politician arrives at Hogg's Garage to pick up her car, which had to be repaired when visibility through the windshield was slightly obscured by the unfortunate appearance of an axe in the hood. Bobo has repaired and repainted it, but when the woman goes to take out her wallet, the boy shakes his head and says, "It's already been paid for." The boy doesn't say who by, but the woman understands. She drives home, still terrified at the very thought of catching sight of any men in black jackets, but there is nothing threatening waiting outside her door. Just a magnificent bouquet of flowers. The card reads, "Don't be scared, you've still got friends. We won't let the forces of darkness win. Richard Tiu." The woman calls to thank him. Tiu is humble, says he doesn't want anything in return, and she respects him for that. He smiles as he hangs up. He often has a plan, but not always. Sometimes he's just like a good hockey player. He's got quick reflexes. That afternoon, just before midsummer, after the establishment politicians had their meeting with Peter about Beartown hockey, the insecure female counselor was standing in the corridor, not daring to go outside. Richard Tiu passed her at the coffee machine and asked, "You look worried. What's the matter?" The female counselor represented a party that had publicly distanced itself, in the strongest possible terms, from Richard Tiu. But a few kind words can go a long way. She admitted, "Oh, I don't know. Everyone's saying that Beartown Ice Hockey is going to go bankrupt, but I've got no interest in sports. What am I supposed to say if anyone asks me?" Tiu put his hand on her shoulder and said, "It's not that serious. The council still has another hockey club after all. Just say that everyone ought to start supporting head hockey instead." And the woman walked out of the council building, and while a Hyeot fan was filming her, she said exactly that. Then she got an axe embedded in the hood of her car. Her party colleagues weren't remotely sympathetic the next day and just snapped, "How could you be stupid enough to say that everyone ought to support Hyeot in this council district?" What was she supposed to say to that? That Richard Tiu had told her to say it? She kept her mouth shut. Her party colleagues yelled at her, and she burst into tears when they weren't looking. That evening, Tiu came to her office, listened and commiserated, even apologized to her. She had new enemies, so she needed a friend. Tiu offered to drive her car to a garage, promised to pay for the damage, told her not to worry. He drove her home and told her to call him if she felt even remotely threatened, no matter what time it was. "You don't have to be afraid. You have good friends," he reminded her. Then he said, "I'll see to it that the club punishes the hooligans who attacked you. I'm going to get them to do away with the standing area in the rink." None of the woman's party colleagues asked how she was. None of them reached their hand out to her. So she took the only one on offer, which belonged to someone with quick reflexes. The Spanish homeowning politician realizes his mistake the moment he sees the newspaper, quickly abandons his holiday, and returns home. He is met at the airport by Richard Tiu. "What are you doing here?" the Spanish homeowning politician asks.
"I want to help you,"
Tiu says. The Spanish homeowning politician laughs. "Really? We've never exactly been on the same side." But he is curious, and the newspaper articles about the hospital have put him into a tight corner. So Tiu offers to get him a cup of coffee, then explains good-naturedly that, "You and I both want what's best for the area,
and that no one gains anything from anxiety and discord. They talk a bit about the articles about the hospital, and Chiyu laments the fact that everything has been unfortunately expressed. The Spanish homeowning politician spends a while cursing bastard journalists, after which Chiyu suddenly exclaims, "Have you heard about Beartown Ice Hockey's new sponsor?" The Spanish homeowning politician nods, then grunts, "Yes, everyone seems to be talking about it, but no one seems to know who this mysterious sponsor actually is." Chiyu leans forward and reveals, "It's a company that's going to buy the factory in Beartown. They've contacted me. I can let you hold the press conference when the deal becomes official. There'll be a lot of new jobs for the area." The Spanish homeowning politician stammers, "How do you... I hadn't even heard." Without going into detail, Tio explains that he was tipped off by some old friends from his banking days in London. He also explains what the factory's new owners are hoping to get from the council. Obviously, they need a degree of political goodwill, investment in infrastructure. The Spanish homeowning politician understands what that means. Subsidized land, reduced rent, more or less public subsidies for the restructuring of the factory. But he also appreciates the value of being the politician who can promise new jobs at a press conference. "Why are you telling me this?" he asks suspiciously. "Because I don't want to be your enemy," Tio replies gently. The Spanish homeowning politician laughs out loud at that. "You're a horse trader, Richard. What do you want?" Richard Teal replies calmly, "A seat at future negotiation tables. You just have to mention me and my party during the press conference, open the door to future cooperation, and the other parties will follow your lead."
"You want me to clean up your political reputation?"
"I'm offering you the chance to be the politician who saves jobs in Beartown." The Spanish homeowning politician plays hard to get, but he's already sold. So he requests just one thing from Tiu.
"All the new jobs at the factory have to go to people from Beartown. Under no circumstances must my party be seen to be favoring Hied right now."
Richard Tiu makes a solemn promise. It isn't worth much. He has nothing against the Spanish homeowning politician. They're actually fairly similar, but that's the problem. The Spanish homeowning politician knows everyone with money in the area, but he's also known to be a lover of sports who has always done his best to prop up the hockey clubs. And that's a dangerous combination. Richard Tiu needs an opponent who's easier to beat. So when the Spanish homeowning politician is driving home, Tiu calls his friend in London at once.
"It's done. The new owners will get everything they need. There's just one thing that's cropped up."
The factory's new owners naturally understand when Tiu explains that, bearing in mind the heated local debate about the closure of the hospital, it would be greatly appreciated, among local politicians, if the new owners could give an undertaking to recruit a large number of their new workers from Hied, so that no one thinks that Beartown is being shown any favoritism. One evening, toward the end of the summer, Richard Tiu knocks on a front door. The female politician looks surprised when she opens it. She asks Tiu in, but he smiles apologetically and says he doesn't want to disturb her. He can see her husband and children inside the house. The factory's new owners are going public with the deal soon. They're going to announce new jobs and the fact that they'll be sponsoring Beartown Ice Hockey. They're going to hold a press conference with the politicians who have made the deal possible, Tiu says. The woman isn't skilled enough at the game to understand how this affects her, so she says,
"Congratulations, that'll be a feather in your cap for the next election."
Tiu smiles modestly. "I won't be there. But your party will be there, of course, seeing as you're still the biggest party on the council." "I'm not high enough up the hierarchy to take part in a press conference, especially after, you know, the axe in my car," the woman says. Tiu is gratified that there's a note of anger as well as fear in her voice. "What if I could arrange for you to be there, next to the leader of your party?"
"You can't do that, can you?"
She falls silent, but Tiu says nothing. So the woman goes on. What do you want from me?
I want to be your friend, he says.
What do I have to say at the press conference? She asks, a little too eagerly.
The truth, that it isn't just Beartown that needs jobs, but Hied too. A responsible politician always thinks about the whole district.
The woman shakes her head, her eyelids flutter.
I can't. You must see that I can't possibly.
Tiu's hand touches hers, calm and reassuring.
You're scared. Don't be. No one's going to hurt you.
She sees in his eyes that he's serious. She gasps,
So you want me to demand that some of the jobs in the factory must go to people living in Hied?
He nods.
Half. Do you have any idea how hated that will make me in Beartown?
Richard Tiu shrugs his shoulders pragmatically.
Yes, but they'll love you in Hied, and Hied has a bigger population. If you're already hated in one place, you have to try even harder to be loved in the other. You don't win elections by having as few enemies as possible, only by having the most friends. Is this even legal? Can you even... What happens if my party expels me?
You misunderstand me. You won't just have a place in your party after this. You'll be its leader. Richard Tiu is serious when he says this, too. Chapter 18. A Woman. Summer in Beartown is capable of enchanting anyone. The way the scent of roses gets stronger in darkened rooms. The way the light in a place so used to darkness is emotionally overwhelming. Greenery suddenly froths around us. It's light almost all night through. Warm breezes chase one another around the corners of buildings like calves let out to pasture. But we have learned never to trust the heat. It's fleeting and unreliable and always lets us down. The trees shed their clothing quickly in this part of the country, all at once, like a nightdress. The days soon grow shorter, the horizon comes closer. Sooner than we realize, winter falls, white, and erases all the color of the other seasons. The world becomes a blank piece of paper again, a frozen, freshly ironed sheet when we look out of the window one morning. We've pulled our boats from the lake, leaving parts of ourselves in the bottom of them. The people we were in July, those summer people, will rest on a bed of wood deep below the snow for so many months that we will almost have forgotten them by next spring. September is on its way. A time that belongs to those who love hockey. Our year starts now. Fatima and Aunt Katrine are finishing their shifts at the hospital. Every doctor who passes wants only to talk about hockey. The local paper's revelation that there's a mysterious new sponsor who's going to save Beartown ice hockey is the big topic of conversation in both Beartown and Hied.
What a season this is going to be,
one nurse exclaims in the staff room and immediately falls out with a nurse who supports the other team. Hied should have gotten that new sponsor instead.
This district isn't big enough for two hockey teams, one of them says.
Ha! Why not close down Hied if you can't survive without council money, the other suggests. It starts off as friendly squabbling, but Fatima and Aunt Katrine have followed hockey in these towns long enough to know that it will soon lead to genuine conflict, not just in the hospital, but everywhere. People's best and worst feelings about one another will explode when Beartown and Hied play each other. Sports is so much more than just sports around here, especially this season. When Fatima and Aunt Katrine emerge from the hospital at the end of their shifts, a man in a tracksuit top is waiting in the parking lot.
Peter, what are you doing here? Aunt Katrine asks in surprise when she catches sight of Beartown Ice Hockey's general manager in the distance.
I need to ask you both for something, Peter says.
What? Aunt Katrine wonders.
Your sons.
Fatima and Aunt Katrine start to laugh, then they realize he isn't joking.
Are you feeling okay, Peter?
Fatima asks anxiously.
He nods sternly. We've got a new coach, as you may have heard, and she wants to build the club around your boys.
Aunt Katrine tries to read his tone of voice,
asks, "And you don't think that's a good idea?" The corners of Peter's mouth twitch, but he lowers his gaze. "I've always tried to build a hockey club that was more than just a hockey club. I wanted it to foster young men as much as it did hockey players. I didn't want winning to be the most important thing. But we've got a new sponsor now, and if we don't win this season, if we don't manage to beat Hied and get promoted to a higher league, then I don't know if we'll still be here next year."
"Just say what you came to say," Ann-Katrine says impatiently.
Peter's chest rises and falls. "I'm afraid the club might demand more from your sons than it can give back to them."
"How?"
Fatima asks. Peter turns to her. "Ahmet stopped me when I was driving a while back. He asked if he was going to be able to play in the junior team, and I wasn't very nice to him."
"Everyone has their bad moments. You're no worse than anyone else."
Fatima smiles, but Peter cuts her off. "He asked about the junior team, Fatima, but dear Lord, we don't want Ahmet on a junior team. We want him on the A team." Fatima swallows.
With all the grown men?"
Peter doesn't attempt to hide the truth from her. "It's going to make huge demands of him, and all the older players will go for him extra hard. There have been plenty before him who've been broken by that. Being the youngest in the team, surrounded by adults, it won't be easy for him." The look in Fatima's eyes is implacable.
"No one's ever promised my son that it would be."
Peter tugs his beard in embarrassment. "I should have told Ahmet that my daughter and I still owe him a huge debt of gratitude for standing up at that meeting back in the spring and telling the truth." Fatima shakes her head.
"You can give him your thanks, but Maya doesn't owe anyone anything. We should be asking her forgiveness. The whole town. As far as my son is concerned, he just wants to play hockey. So he'll play if you can give him somewhere to do it."
Peter nods gratefully. Then he turns to Ann-Katrine. "I'm not going to lie to you." Ann-Katrine smiles.
"You wouldn't dare."
She's married to Hogg, Peter's childhood friend, and has seen Peter get older almost as closely as she has her husband. So Peter tells it like it is. "We need Bobo this season. We've got a shortage of defensemen, but to be completely honest, he's not good enough to play at a higher level. So if we win, if he helps us move up to a higher league, he won't stand a chance of making the team next season. This season will be his last. I'll demand blood, sweat, and tears from him. He'll have to prioritize hockey ahead of everything else, school, girls, everything. But I can only offer him 1 year in return." Ann-Katrine breathes through her nose. Her body hurts. In hindsight, Peter will think she looked thin and exhausted because she'd just worked a difficult late shift. Like almost everyone else, he doesn't know about her illness. That's as it should be. She doesn't want their sympathy. But she does want to watch her son play hockey one last time. So she smiles.
1 year? A year is an eternity.
Her husband, Hogg, had to stop playing hockey after suffering one too many concussions. The doctors forced him to give up, and he was quiet for weeks, grieving for himself as if he'd attended his own funeral. For months, he couldn't bring himself to go near the rink because he felt he'd let his team down. Let them down, because he wasn't immortal. Bobo has inherited his broad shoulders and brute strength from his dad, but he's also inherited his need to be part of a gang. They both hate being alone. They need a context in which they feel loved and accepted. So when Hogg no longer had the locker room to go to, it was as if part of him had been amputated. What wouldn't he have given for 1 more year? 1 last game. 1 last moment where you can feel your whole life in your gut, and the spectators are roaring and everything is at stake. Ann-Katrine will hardly be able to stand when she gets home tonight, and Hogg will fetch her from the car. That big, clumsy lump of a man will carry her into the house, and when she's too tired to dance, he'll spin her around slowly and tenderly in his arms across the kitchen floor. She'll fall asleep with his lips against her neck, his still infatuated hands beneath her top. Bobo will read Harry Potter to his brother and sister in another room. Early tomorrow morning, Ann-Katrine will go back to see her doctor again.
1 year? What wouldn't we give for one more year? A year is an eternity. Five old uncles are sitting at the counter in the bearskin again. They've got something new to argue about. A woman, though, as a hockey coach? Is that really a good idea? One of them asks.
Can't help thinking this whole equality thing has gone a bit too far, another says.
Oh, shut up. That woman's probably forgotten more about hockey than the pair of you have ever known, you senile old fools, a third protests.
You think? You can't tell the difference between icing and ice cream. All last season I had to sit there like a guide dog telling you where the puck was, the fourth chuckles.
Can you get talking guide dogs these days, then? It's bad enough that you keep lying about watching the 1987 World Championships in Switzerland, the fifth says.
I did, the fourth insists.
Really? Pretty impressive, seeing as the 1987 World Championships were held in Austria, the fifth points out. They laugh, all five of them.
Then the first, or possibly the second, says,
But a woman as coach? Is that really a good idea?
She sleeps with women, too, they say. Are we really going to have one of those in this town? Wonders the second, unless it's actually the first.
The fourth or fifth retorts, There are probably more here already. They're everywhere these days.
The first snorts, It's all very well if they're discreet about it, but why does everyone have to make such a fuss about things?
Does everything have to be political now?
The third leans forward on his bar stool, and it's hard to know if it's the chair or his body creaking when he asks Ramona for another beer. As she pours it, he says,
I tell you, if this new coach beats Hied in the first game, she can sleep with my wife for all I care.
They laugh again, all five of them, at one another as much as with them. Ramona gets out some nibbles for them, the old bastards. Nuts for the nuts. Peter rings on the door of the Ovich family's row house. Benji's mom opens it.
Peter, come in and eat,
she commands at once, as if he were late, even though he hasn't seen the woman and he doesn't know how long. Benji isn't home, which Peter is pleased about. He's not here to see him. All three of his sisters are sitting in the kitchen, Audrey, Katya, and Gabby. Their mother cuffs each of them across the forehead in turn for not laying a place for their guest quickly enough.
I won't stay long. I've already eaten, Peter starts to say, but Audrey grabs his arm.
Shh. If you turn down Mom's food, you're a braver man than I thought. Peter smiles, at first amused, then alarmed. You can joke about most things with the Ovich family, but not food. So Peter eats, three helpings more than he can manage, plus coffee and four different types of biscuits, and is given the rest to take home in plastic containers and aluminum foil. Audrey walks him happily to the door.
You've only got yourself to blame if you show up here at dinner time.
Peter puts a hand on his stomach.
I wanted to talk about Benjamin.
We realize that. That's why we let Mom talk to you about everything else, Audrey says with an even broader grin. She composes herself when she sees the serious look in Peter's eyes.
We've got a new coach, Elizabeth Zekel.
So I've heard. Everyone's heard that. It's even been in the paper. Peter holds out a crumpled sheet of paper. Audrey reads the names, sees her brother's, but it's as if she doesn't quite grasp the significance of the C beside it. Peter helps her out.
She wants to make Benji team captain.
Of the A-team? Grown men? Benji's...
I know. But this Elizabeth Zekel doesn't seem... How can I put it? She doesn't do things the way other people do, Peter says forlornly.
Audrey smiles.
No, and thank God for that, but my brother as captain? Does she have any idea what she's letting herself in for? She says she doesn't want a team, she wants a gang of bandits. Can you think of anyone who'd make a better bandit than your brother?
Audrey tilts her head to one side. What do you want from me?
You have to help me control him.
No one can do that. Peter scratches his neck nervously.
I've never been much good with people, Audrey, but this Elizabeth Zekel, she's...
Even worse, Audrey suggests.
Yes, how did you guess?
Suna called me. He said you'd be showing up.
So you let me sit through that whole meal completely unnecessarily?
Peter exclaims.
Are you saying there's something wrong with my mom's cooking?
Audrey snaps, so sharply that Peter backs away with his hands in the air, as if he were being robbed in an old cowboy film.
Please, Audrey, just help me. We need Benji if we're going to stand any chance of winning.
Audrey looks at the sheet of paper in her hand.
But you need a Benji who's a leader.
A bandit, but not a lunatic.
We need a Benji who's not quite so Benji as usual.
I'll do what I can, Audrey promises. Peter nods gratefully.
And we need you as coach of the girls' team, if you're still up for that. I can't afford to pay you, and I know it's a thankless task.
It's not thankless, Audrey says. Peter can see the fire inside her. You understand it only if you're a hockey person. They part with a firm handshake, the general manager and the sister, the father and the girls' team's coach. But before Peter leaves, Audrey asks,
Who are you getting the money from? Who's this mystery sponsor the paper's been writing about? What do they want?
Who says they want anything?
Everyone with money wants something, Peter, especially when it comes to money and hockey.
I can't say anything until it's official.
You can understand that, can't you?
Peter pleads.
Audrey's reply sounds almost threatening, but is actually sympathetic.
Just don't forget who stood up for the club when things were at their worst. Audrey doesn't have to mention the pack. Peter knows what she means by the people who stood up.
I'll do my best, he promises. Even though they're both well aware that that's never enough in this town.
Chapter 19. The Same Blue Polo Shirt. It's still warm when the autumn term starts at Beartown School. The sun is shining, the clouds are drifting light and high, the temperature is still lying treacherously about short sleeves and garden furniture, but if you've lived here all your life, you can feel winter coming. The cold will soon freeze the lakes, snowflakes will fall, heavy as oven gloves, and darkness will land on the town as if it had been attacked from behind by an angry giant who tosses all the buildings into a black sack to use on the model railway in the secret room in his basement. It feels as though in Beartown, every year comes to an end in August, which may be why it's so easy to love a sport that starts in September. Outside the school building, someone has hung green flags in the trees. This seems innocent enough to a lot of people, but to others it is a provocation. It doesn't start here, but it gets worse from here. Anna and Maya are standing 200 feet from the entrance, taking deep breaths and holding each other by the hand. All summer they have been free, but a school is a different sort of island. It's not the sort where you can hide away with your best friend, but one where you drift ashore unwillingly after some terrible accident. All the pupils are shipwrecked here. None of them has chosen the company of the others. They're all just trying to stay alive until the term is over and they can get out of here.
Are you sure you don't want me to get my rifle? Anna asks.
Maya laughs.
Fairly sure.
I wouldn't shoot anyone. Not badly, anyway, Anna promises.
You can put laxative in the milk dispenser in the cafeteria if anyone's stupid, Maya says.
And take the light bulbs out of all the bathrooms and stretch plastic wrap across all the toilets, Anna nods.
Maya laughs. You're so sick. Don't let the bastards see you cry. Anna whispers.
Never, Maya replies.
They walk into the school side by side. The stairs cut into their skin. The silence threatens to burst their temples. But they walk with their heads held high. The two of them against the world. The walk to Maya's locker is less than 100 feet, but nothing in life will ever frighten them so much. Two young women striding straight through a school full of whispers, without lowering their eyes once. You can't show these women a damn thing after what they've already seen. William Leet is marching along the corridor surrounded by four of his teammates. Maybe they're not actively seeking out foes. Maybe they just swing around the corner and bump into Bobo by accident. But the fight is instantaneous, almost instinctive in its clumsiness. And in the narrow corridor, the young men flail around as if they'd stumbled into a swarm of bees. In the spring, when Amit stood up at that meeting in the rink and said he'd seen Kevin rape Maya, some of these guys set off toward the hollow one night to punish him. Bobo was with them, but changed sides at the last minute. If he hadn't taken such a severe beating for his new friend, they might well have killed Amit. That fight isn't over yet. Someone pushes Bobo, and he falls backward along the corridor. Everyone is shouting, but Leet and his allies quickly fall silent. Bobo is lying on the floor, and a couple of feet behind him stands Benji. He doesn't say anything, just stands there with his eyes half open and his hair a mess, as if they'd started the fight next to the bench he'd spent the night sleeping under. Hands in pockets, an arrogant look in his eye, so certain of his own effect that it isn't even meant to be threatening. "Are we going to do this now, Leet, or do you want to fetch more friends first?" Benji asks, as if he was wondering if Leet wanted a medium or large drink with his burger. Leet's friends glance at him for guidance. Leet meets Benji's gaze, but not for long. He manages to utter an insult, but it doesn't sound particularly convincing as he mumbles, "Who cares? We'll do this on the ice instead. Good luck with your goddamn lesbian coach. She suits you. You've always played like pussies." Benji is standing on his toes, Leet on his heels. When the teachers come hurrying through the corridor, Leet raises his hands a little too quickly and pretends it's their fault, and he sets off in the other direction. But Benji doesn't move, doesn't look down, and everyone who sees that knows what it means for the balance of power in the school. One of the pupils who pays extra attention is Leo Anderson. Maya and Anna are standing at Maya's locker when they hear the commotion and shouting. It's as if school buildings are intentionally built with acoustics so that sounds will always reach you no matter where you are, so that the pupils will never be able to escape one another. Maya sees the staff hurry toward the disturbance, sees some final-year students swinging wildly at each other farther along one of the corridors. She realizes it's ridiculous the moment the words leave her mouth, but she asks out loud, "What are they fighting about now?" A girl the same age as her spins around a couple of feet away, her voice dripping with derision when she replies, "Don't act stupid, you lying piece of..." One of the girl's friends stops her before she says the last word, as if that makes any difference. Maya stares at her slightly too long. The girl's eyes are wide open, her fingernails digging into her palms as she shouts, "Like you don't know what they're fighting about. You're enjoying this, aren't you? The fact that all the trouble in this whole damn town is about you. Maya Anderson, Beartown's very own little princess." She says Maya's name as if she were spitting on her grave. The girl's friends pull her away. She's got a red He Had Hockey badge on her backpack. Her boyfriend and brother both play there. They used to be friends with Kevin Erdahl. Maya and Anna stay where they are, leaning against the lockers so hard they can feel the metal doors shake in time with their heartbeats. This will never end. Never. Maya groans in resignation. How many things can they actually hate me for? I'm either a rape victim or a lying bitch. Or a princess? Anna stands beside her, staring at the floor, then clears her throat noisily and suggests, "Look, if it's any consolation, I still think you're just a perfectly ordinary idiot." Maya's mouth struggles to remain solemn, but can't resist breaking into a broad grin. "You're so says the idiot," Anna snorts. Maya bursts out laughing. You must never let the bastards see you do the opposite. Bobo is crawling about on the floor like an overweight deer. Amit runs over and holds out his hand, and together with Benji pulls him to his feet, groaning. Amit grins. How can you possibly be so heavy but so easy to knock over? Bobo, who isn't exactly known for his sharp wits, unexpectedly manages to fire back. My cock affects my center of gravity. Amit and Benji's laughter echoes along the corridor. They're the only three members of last season's junior team who are still with Beartown Ice Hockey, and right now that feels as though it might just be enough.
Have you heard I'm practicing with the A-team today? Amit asks excitedly.
Bobo nods, then looks suddenly perplexed.
What did Leap mean, lesbian coach?
Amit and Benji stare at him in surprise.
You haven't heard that Beartown's A-team has got a new coach?
Bobo's face radiates incomprehension. Rumors may spread quickly in Beartown, but not quickly enough to reach Bobo.
Yeah, but a lesbian? We're going to have a lesbian coach?
Benji says nothing, but Amit clears his throat.
Bobo, we said the A-team.
Are you saying I don't belong on the A-team?
Bobo snaps. Amit shrugs.
If we need an extra obstacle in training, maybe. Your skates are actually faster when you're not wearing them.
Benji bursts out laughing and Bobo tries to grab Amit, but Amit is far, far too quick for him. They're joking, all three of them, but deep down, none of them knows if he's really good enough. If there's any chance of their making the A-team.
And where would that leave them? If they're no longer hockey players.
The school slowly fills with staff and students. A new term, equal measures of expectation and anxiety. Bittersweet reunions with everyone you love and everyone you hate. And the knowledge that there's no way to avoid breathing the same air as both groups. In the headmaster's office sits a young teacher, Jeanette, making a last attempt to persuade the man in the smart jacket who's massaging his temples in front of her.
Just give me a chance. Let me turn it into part of PE.
The headmaster sighs. Please, Jeanette, after everything that happened this spring, I just want to get this school through one term without any scandals and attention from the media. And you want to teach the students how to fight?
It's not for heaven's sake. It's martial arts,
Jeanette snaps.
What did you say it was called again?
MMA, mixed martial arts, Jeanette repeats patiently. The headmaster rolls his eyes.
Arts? That always seems a bit odd to call it an art, don't you think? It's not like you can put on an exhibition of broken noses, is it?
Jeanette clasps her hands together in her lap, possibly to stop herself from throwing something at him.
Martial arts teaches students discipline and respect for their own and other people's bodies. I've already got somewhere to do it, up at Audrey Ovich's kennels. Just let me ask the students if they're interested, and...
The headmaster polishes his glasses more thoroughly than necessary.
I'm sorry, Jeanette, the parents would go mad. They'd see it as you teaching their children to be violent. We can't afford any more controversy.
He stands up to indicate that it's time for Jeanette to leave his office, but the moment he opens the door, a hand very nearly hits him in the face. The man standing outside was just about to knock on the door.
I've got a feeling this is going to be a very long year, the headmaster mutters.
Jeanette is standing behind him, unable to conceal her curiosity.
Hi, she says.
The man in the doorway smiles. I'm starting work here today, he says.
Yes, our new philosophy and history teacher, the headmaster exclaims, grabbing some sheets of paper from a shelf before adding, and maths and science and French. Do you speak French?
The male teacher in the doorway looks as though he's about to protest, but Jeanette gestures with a smile that he should go along with it. The headmaster heaves a pile of books and papers into his arms.
Best get going, then. Your schedule's on top there.
The teacher thanks him and sets off along the corridor. The headmaster watches him go and sighs,
freshly qualified. I know I should be happy that he's come here of his own volition, but dear Lord, Jeanette, how old do you think he is?
25, 26, Jeanette guesses.
And you saw the way he looks.
I didn't notice a thing, Jeanette deadpans.
The school is raging with hormones, and we employ a teacher who looks like he's in a bloody boy band. We'll have to lock up half the female students, the headmaster mutters.
Jeanette coughs under her breath. And probably some of the female teachers, too.
What? The headmaster says.
What?
Jeanette repeats innocently.
Did you say something?
No, I've got a class now.
The headmaster mutters unhappily.
You can put up one poster about your martial arts training. One poster, Jeanette.
Jeanette nods and goes out into the corridor. She pins up four posters, and watches the new teacher's hips as she heads after him along the corridor. The new teacher is standing in the classroom, writing on the board as the students tumble into the room in little clusters. When the bell rings, it can barely be heard over the scrape of chairs and the sound of backpacks being dropped on the floor, as well as the enthusiastic chatter about everything that's happened during the summer and the fight that just broke out in the corridor. Benji comes in last of all, and hardly anyone notices him. His hair is still a mess, his denim shirt is half tucked in, as if he'd just pulled on his pants in a darkened room. He looks the way he did when he got out of the bed in a cabin in a campsite between Beartown and Hied not long ago, on the night that was full of Nietzsche and cold beer and warm hands. All the other students in the room are too preoccupied with one another and themselves to see the new teacher turn toward the door and lose his breath. Benji's not an easy young man to surprise, but he stops, his chest pounding with shock. The teacher is wearing the same blue polo shirt as he was that night. Chapter 20. Shaving cream in your shoes. It's hard to care about people. Exhausting, in fact, because empathy is a complicated thing. It requires us to accept that everyone else's lives are also going on the whole time. We have no pause button for when everything gets too much for us to deal with, but then neither does anyone else. When the class is over, the students rush out of the classroom as if it were on fire, as usual. Benji seems to be last by accident. He's good at giving the impression of nonchalance. The teacher is sweating with nerves, the collar of his blue polo shirt flecked with moisture. I didn't know you were still at school, Benjamin. If I'd known, I thought you were older. It was a mistake. I could lose my job. We shouldn't have slept together. I don't make a habit. You were just... Benji steps closer to him. The teacher's hands are shaking. Just a mistake. I was just a mistake, Benji says, finishing his sentence for him. The teacher nods helplessly with his eyes closed. Benji stares at his lips for a few moments. When the teacher opens his eyes again, Benji is already gone. Bobo goes straight home after school as usual, throws his backpack into his room, gets changed, and goes out to help his dad, Hog, in the workshop, just as he always does. But today, Hog, rather than Bobo, is the one keeping an eye on the clock. "That's enough, Bobo. Get going," Hog says when it's time. Bobo nods, relieved, and shrugs off his overalls. Hog notes that they're getting to be too small for him. While Bobo fetches his hockey gear, Hog hesitates for a long time before saying anything, possibly because he doesn't want his son to see how full of anticipation he is. Father's hopes can so easily suffocate their sons. But in the end, he can't help asking, "Nervous?" It's a stupid question. Bobo's as nervous as a long-tailed cat between two rocking chairs. This is his first training session with the A-team. He's 18 years old, and hockey has a definitive way of letting children know when they've grown up. The son shakes his head, but his eyes are nodding. His dad grins. "Keep your head down and your mouth shut. Do your best. And wear a pair of shoes you don't like." Bobo opens his mouth to make the noise he's made ever since he was little when he doesn't understand something. "Huh?" "The older A-team players will fill your shoes with shaving cream while you're in the shower. They'll make life hell to start with, but you just have to accept that. Remember, it's a sign that they respect you. It's when they're not messing with you that you need to be worried, because that means they know you're on your way out of the team." Bobo nods. Hog looks as though he's about to pat him on the shoulder, but reaches for a tool from the bench behind him instead. Bobo turns to go change his shoes, but Hog clears his throat. "Thanks for your help today." Bobo doesn't know what to say. He helps his dad in the workshop every day, but his dad never thanks him. But today he goes on. "I wish your life could be less complicated, that you only had to worry about school and hockey and girls and whatever your friends worry about. I know it's been tough having to help in the workshop, and now all this business with your mom, not..." He tails off. Bobo doesn't finish the sentence. He just says,
No problem, Dad.
I'm so damn proud of you, Hog says, looking down under the hood of a Ford. Bobo goes and gets an old pair of shoes.
Ahmet is the smallest guy in the locker room. He's doing his best to make himself even smaller. He can feel the way the older players are looking at him and knows they don't want him there. Bobo's sitting beside him, and it's worse for him because he's big. The older players, the ones who didn't find other teams when the club was teetering close to bankruptcy in the summer, and are damned if they're going to lose their places to a gang of juniors now, immediately start to target him. Just little things. Someone hitting him with his shoulder. Someone accidentally kicking his gear across the floor. As they start to joke about noisily, Bobo desperately tries to make funny comments. It's obvious that he's trying too hard to gain acceptance, and for that reason it only makes things worse. Ahmet tries to nudge him with his elbow to get him to shut up, but Bobo is on a roll. One of the older players grunts, "So we're getting a female coach now, too? Can't the GM find some other way to drum up a bit of PR? Are we going to end up as some sort of political gesture?"
"There's no way she got the job on her own merits. This is to meet a quota," another snaps.
"Have you heard she's a lesbian?"
Bobo blurts out a little too loudly. The older players ignore him, but one of them says, "Definitely a rug muncher. You can tell just by looking at her."
"Huh? What's a rug muncher?" "Oh, hang on. I get it. Lesbian, right? I get it,"
Bobo yelps. No one reacts. The older players just go on. "Can't a hockey team just be a hockey team? Does everything have to be political? It's only a matter of time before they replace the bear on our shirts with a goddamn rainbow." As if struck by lightning, Bobo exclaims,
"And force us to play in, like, ballerinas' tutus."
He stands up and does a clumsy pirouette, stumbles into a bench, loses his balance, and falls flat on his back on top of two hockey bags. Then something happens. A couple of the older players laugh. At him, rather than with him, but as long as they're looking at him, he devours their attention. He gets to his feet and does another pirouette, and one of the older guys pretends to be serious and says, "Your name's Bobo, right?"
"Yes,"
Bobo nods intently. The other players grin expectantly, aware that the older man is teasing the boy.
"You ought to show her your cock," he says.
"Huh?"
Bobo says. The older player points at him demonstratively.
"The new coach. She's a lesbian. Show her your cock so she can see what she's missing."
"Let the anaconda out of the cage, Bobo. You're not chicken, are you?"
another player cries, and soon they're all shouting, as if he were getting ready to attempt the long jump.
"But she, won't she be angry?"
Bobo wonders in confusion.
"She'll just think you've got a decent sense of humor,"
one of the older players replies eagerly.
In hindsight, it's easy to say that Bobo's crazy, but when you're 18 years old in a locker room full of grown men who are suddenly cheering you on, no is the hardest word in the world. So when Elizabeth Zakel walks past in the corridor, Bobo leaps out of the locker room as naked as the day he was born. He's expecting her to be shocked, or at least jump. She doesn't even raise an eyebrow.
"Yes?" she asks. Bobo squirms.
Well, we heard you were a lesbian, so I..."
"Bobo wanted to show you his cock so you know what you're missing,"
someone shouts from the locker room, followed by two dozen men giggling hysterically. Zakel puts her hands on her knees and leans forward in interest toward Bobo's crotch.
"That?"
she wonders, pointing curiously.
"Huh?"
Bobo says.
"Is that the cock you're talking about? Wow. I've seen women with bigger clitorises than that."
Then she turns and walks toward the ice without another word. Bobo has turned bright red all over when he steps back inside the locker room.
"It's okay," she said. "A clitoris can't get this big, can it? I mean, how big can a clitoris get, roughly?"
The locker room is rocking with mocking laughter. At him, not with him. But Bobo is still smiling sheepishly, because sometimes any attention at all can still feel like validation.
Ahmed is squirming inside his gear as he looks at Bobo, already thinking that this is going to end badly. When the practice begins, the players gather around the center circle at a very leisurely pace, demonstratively arrogant, to show Elizabeth Zakel that she's not welcome. She doesn't seem to pick up the hint at all, just comes out with 6 buckets under her arm. What are you good at in Beartown? When no one answers, she shrugs her shoulders. I've watched all your games from last season, so I know you're completely useless at pretty much everything. It would really help me to know what you're good at. Someone tries to mumble a joke. Drinking and fucking. But not even that raises more than a stifled grunt from the rest of the group. Then someone suddenly starts to laugh, not at the remark, but at something happening on the ice, behind Zakel. Bobo is skating out from the bench, over 200 pounds of him, wearing a skirt he's stolen from the figure skater's storeroom. He performs 3 pirouettes in a row and is met by applause and cheering from the older players at the center circle. Elizabeth Zakel lets him carry on, even though they're no longer laughing at Bobo, but at her. But when Bobo is halfway through his 4th pirouette, the cheering suddenly stops. And before Bobo knows what's hit him, everything goes black. When he opens his eyes, he's lying on the ice. He can hardly breathe. Elizabeth Zakel is leaning over him expressionlessly and says, "Why hasn't anyone taught you to skate properly?" "Huh?" "You roll like a fairy, but I've seen you pull an axe from the hood of a car. If you could skate properly, I'd never be able to knock you down that easily. And then you wouldn't be utterly worthless as a hockey player. So why hasn't anyone ever taught you?"
I don't know,"
Bobo gasps, still lying on his back with his chest aching as if he'd been run over rather than tackled. "What are you good at in Beartown?" Zakel asks seriously. At first, Bobo doesn't answer, so Zakel gives up and skates back to the center circle. The young man slowly crawls up from the ice, pulls off the skirt, and says in a voice that sounds both angry and humiliated, "Hard work! We are good at hard work in Beartown. People can say a lot of shit about this town, but we know about hard work." The older players squirm, but no one protests. So Elizabeth Zakel says, "Okay, then that's how we win. We work harder than all the others. If you need to be sick, do it in these. I've heard the GM doesn't like mess, so I dare say he doesn't want vomit on the ice. I take it you're familiar with how to skate lengths?" The players groan loudly, which she interprets as yes. She sets out the buckets she brought with her. The rest of the practice consists of excruciating fitness exercises, skating at top speed between the boards, then darting sideways, wrestling, work, work, work. Not a single bucket is empty by the time they're done. And the only player still standing at the end is Ahmet. At first, the older players try to stop him. Not obviously, but by little tricks that look like accidents. A sharp elbow in the corner, pulling his jersey when he's about to take off. A discreet skate nudging his to make him lose his balance. Most of the players on the ice are 50 or 60 pounds heavier than Ahmet, so just leaning on him is enough. It isn't Ahmet's fault that they're doing this. He's not trying to show off or draw attention to himself. He's simply too good. He makes the others look slow, and they can't tolerate that. Time after time, they trip him, and time after time, he gets up, skates faster, fights harder, digs deeper inside himself. The look in his eyes gets blacker and blacker. No one knows what the time is. Elizabeth Zakel shows no sign of having finished with them. One after the other, the older players crumple and collapse. As they stare down at the ice, Ahmet carries on skating. However many times Zakel orders him to skate from board to board, she can't exhaust him. His jersey is black with sweat, but he's still standing. Bobo is lying on the ice, almost unconscious, and is filled with both pride and envy as he watches his friend work, work, work. Ahmet is the youngest on the team. As he stands in the shower after the practice, his thigh muscles are shaking so much that he can barely keep his balance. When he drags himself into the locker room with his towel around his waist, he sees that his shoes have been filled with shaving cream. And then it's all worth it. When Elizabeth Zekel walks through the rink long after the end of practice, one lone player is sitting in the locker room. Bobo is the size of a dairy cow, yet still as small as a frightened hedgehog. His eyes are moist, staring at a pair of shoes that no one has filled with shaving cream. The only thing the older players roared when he emerged from the shower was, "Thanks very much for the fitness training, you little shit. We're good at hard work? How the hell could you say something so completely stupid to a hockey coach?" Amit tried to comfort him. Bobo laughed it off, and Amit was too exhausted to persist. After he and all the others have gone, Bobo is still sitting in the same place, smallest in the whole world. "Turn the lights out when you leave," Zekel says, because she's not one for this whole business of emotions. Bobo sniffs. "How do you get respect?" he asks, and Zekel looks extremely uncomfortable. You've got snot everywhere," she says, gesturing toward her face with her hand. Bobo wipes himself, and Zekel looks as though she feels like curling up in the fetal position. "I want them to respect me. I want them to put shaving cream in my shoes, too," Bobo says. Zekel groans. "You don't have to be respected. It's not as important as people think." Bobo chews his lips. "Sorry I showed you my cock," he whispers. Zekel stretches herself to smile. "In your defense, it wasn't much of a cock," she says, measuring a few measly inches between her thumb and forefinger. Bobo starts to laugh. Zekel sticks her hands in her pockets and gives him some quiet advice. "You need to be useful to the team, Bobo. Then they'll respect you." She walks off without waiting for him to ask any more questions. Bobo will lie awake at night, wondering what she meant. He stops off at the supermarket on the way home and buys shaving cream so his dad won't be sad. When Hogg sees the ruined shoes in the hall, he gives his son a hug. That doesn't happen often. Chapter 21. He's lying on the ground. Suna is walking slowly through the rink, breathing hard through his nose. He misses his coaching job every second, but he can hardly get up the stands anymore. Hockey gets younger while everyone involved in it gets older, and when it's done with us, it discards us without any sentimentality at all. That's how it develops and stays alive for the sake of new generations. "Zekel," Suna calls out breathlessly when he catches sight of the woman who's taken his job. "Yes," she responds, heading for the locker room. "How did today's practice feel?" "Feel?" Zekel asks, as if it were a foreign word. Suna leans against the wall and smiles weakly. "I mean, it's not easy to be a hockey coach in this town. Especially not if you're, you know." He means, if you're a woman. So Zekel replies, "It's not easy to be a hockey coach anywhere." Suna nods sadly. "I heard that one of the players showed you his genitals." "Hardly," Zekel retorts. Suna coughs awkwardly. "He hardly showed you his genitals?" "It hardly counted as genitals," Zekel corrects. "Oh, that's just, you know, guys. Sometimes they," Suna says, staring down at his knees. Zekel looks annoyed. "How did you know someone showed me his genitals?" Suna misinterprets that to mean that she's upset about the genitals. "I can talk to the guys if you like. I can understand that you feel offended. But you're not to talk to my players. I talk to my players. And the only person who decides if I'm offended is me." Suna raises an eyebrow. "I'm guessing you don't often feel offended?" "Feeling offended is an emotion." Zekel looks as though she's talking about tools when she says the word. Suna sticks his hands in his pockets and mutters, "It's not easy being coach in Beartown, especially if things start to go badly. Believe me, I had my job a whole lifetime before you got here, and there are people in this town who won't be happy with a coach who looks like you do. The old man looks deep into the woman's eyes and sees a characteristic that he always lacked. She doesn't care.